CliffCentral.com.
All right. It is Thursday morning and it is time for the Burning Platform. We always welcome an interesting guest from somewhere in the world. And we also have this morning with us Kanthan Pillay as well, who is our regular comrade on the Burning Platform, where we take on all the stories of the week. Pumi Mashiko is here too. And we welcome Godfrey. It's very nice to have you here, Godfrey. What a pleasure to have you. Godfrey Madanhire, who is, I'll put up your Twitter handle in a moment, a professional speaker. He's a leadership expert, an author, entrepreneur, producer, and host of a podcast called The African Passport, which seeks to promote Pan-Africanism and the integration of the African continent. You've got an uphill battle ahead of you there, especially with South Africa, I'm afraid. What can I say, Godfrey? He was born in Zimbabwe. He permanently moved to SA 23 years ago. He strongly believes that we've been portrayed as a dark continent, a home to war and poverty. And he says it is our responsibility as African citizens to help change the narrative and position us as an equal global partner, which is an admirable charge indeed. So did I get that brief CV right? Are you happy with that?
Thank you very much, Gareth, and thank you very much for having me on the Burning Platform. Let's get it burning.
Absolutely. There's a lot to cover here. Kanthan, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm always awesome.
Let me turn on your microphone. That would help.
Do you know that apropos of swimming, that in order to graduate from Princeton when I went there, you needed to pass a swimming test?
You did?
Yes, and the reason for that was that there was once a undergraduate who drowned, you know, shortly after joining. Jeez. And so learning how to swim became compulsory. And I think it's something that needs to happen.
How do you know when someone's been to Princeton?
They tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. Unlike you to bring up your fantastic Ivy League education. All right. So let's talk about some of the things that are going on this week. Godfrey, Kanthan, Pumi, there's a lot to talk about, but let's start off with the obvious reason why you may be an expert in this field, or certainly why we want your commentary, is the Zimbabwean elections and the fact that three presidents, we know Mozambique, South Africa, and one other, I'm not sure who, pitched up at Enoch Godongwana's, Emmerson, because I saw Enoch here in my notes. We've got to talk about him in a minute when it comes to tax. But Emmerson Mnangagwa's house and congratulated him, and Fikile Mbalula was there making friends and influencing people and taking pictures for his Instagram. How do you feel these elections went, and what do you think the real story out of Zimbabwe is? We've got very, very disparate opinions about this in South Africa. But what is your take on this, Godfrey?
All right. I think, like you mentioned, you know, it was, very few presidents who made their way to Zimbabwe for the inauguration of President Emmerson Dambudzo Mnangagwa, you know, popularly known as ED. Obviously, we had the former president.
He's
of
also
Zambia,
popularly known as the crocodile. I just wish to point out.
Sorry, that's right. He's also known as the crocodile, right?
Oh yes, no, that's correct. No, that's correct. No, that's the name he carried during the liberation struggle. And we had former president of Zambia, Edgar Lungu. You know, and they obviously long-time friends with ZANU-PF, which is the ruling party. So it was not surprising to see him there. We had, the president of, from Mozambique, Felipe Nyusi, maybe because also they are expecting elections, coming through. We had, President Cyril Ramaphosa. For me, it was actually a surprise, to see President Cyril Ramaphosa making his way to the inauguration. They wanted as many presidents, to come through to try and, sanitize, the elections. You had President, Tshisekedi from DRC, I think he was also there. And, a surprise guest for me, was the former, first lady, which is my Grace Mugabe, because we know when President Robert Mugabe was still alive, and President Emmerson Mnangagwa was still the vice president, they used to fight, a lot openly.
Yeah.
And for us to see her embracing him now, and we also know that just before President Robert Mugabe passed on, he went out in the public and he denounced the presidents of Emmerson Dambudzo Mnangagwa, and he openly said he was going to vote for the opposition.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we would say she's singing for a supper, but you know, it was very.
So maybe she's just singing for that Manolo Blahnik bag she was holding.
Yeah, she's just after Manolo Blahnik bag. So just tell me, Godfrey, you know, there are people who say, fine, this is all good and well. Was the election free and fair? I mean, people ask this about the US election now, so it's not an unfair question. What do you say to that?
You know, it's you know, when you assess an election, I think you need to start from even the, you know, the pre-election period. You look at the election period and the post-election period. You know, just briefly, if we look at the pre-election period, if we compare what happened in 2018 and what happened in 2023 now, the pre-election period was a bit better for the opposition, because they were allowed to campaign. They even went into some of, you know, the strongholds for the ruling party, you know, ZANU-PF. We also know that, you know, some of their rallies were, you know, were cancelled. You know, the Zimbabwe Republic Police could not you know, allow them to hold those rallies, which is something that is not surprising. You know, they're very limited coverage by the public broadcaster, which is, you know, Zimbabwe Broadcasting, you know, Corporation, and again, that is not surprising. It's very common in Zimbabwe, unlike in South Africa, where you have many, you know, channels, and if the opposition is not happy with the public broadcast, they can always, you know, engage.
Yeah, they've got no chance of doing that in Zim, right?
No, it's not at all, not at all. There's nothing like that. You know, there is you know, a monopoly of the airwaves, if we can put it that way.
And Godfrey, can you give us a feeling about how Zimbabweans in South Africa feel about this election? Because there are a huge number of people who are from Zimbabwe, like you, who live in South Africa now. Many of those people have moved here permanently. You got here 23 years ago. But some people are still coming across today. And, you know, we had JJ Tabane say last week, Zimbabwe must sort itself out. This is not our problem. And why should we care about this? South Africa is being burdened by Zimbabwe's banana republic government. We have to accommodate Zimbabweans in this country. That's not how many of us feel. But that's certainly what he said last week. How do you think Zimbabweans in South Africa are feeling about this election?
Yeah, now, you know, I think I can say Zimbabweans in the diaspora, because you know, I think the feeling is the same. You know, everyone wants a change. I know, you know, people think it is easy for people to leave their home, to leave Zimbabwe, and be in an unfamiliar environment, away from home, and of course, you know, we get used to it. You know, but you know, home will always be home. You know, everyone wants to go back home, and that can only be possible if things change. If things change for the better, so it's an open secret, you know, that most Zimbabweans that are outside the country, you know, we're hoping for change, and it's unfortunate, you know, it didn't happen, you know.
Godfrey, I hear you say. That a lot of people outside, a lot of Zimbabweans who are out in the diaspora, who are all over the world, are hoping for change. Now, just hoping for change isn't going to affect a change. What is it that Zimbabweans are actively doing every day to come to a place of change? So it's also not going to be a single act of showing up on election day to get change. But we don't see that. I think it's the reason why JJ says what he says. This, everybody is kind of feeling a little bit of an exasperation with Zimbabweans that says Zimbabweans actually like what's going on in Zimbabwe because they're not doing enough to change it.
Okay. You know, there's a lot that, you know, Zimbabweans in the diaspora are doing, you know, which might not be out there in the public. I can tell you now, you know, for instance, you know, even this new opposition party, CCC. You know, this is a party that was formed out of the Movement for Democratic Change, you know, when obviously they you know, they left the party. They were forced out of the party, and they had to come up with another party. They didn't have any funding. And who funded that, you know, that organization, or who is funding that organization? It's people that are in the diaspora. People in the diaspora, they also, they might not have gone back home to vote, and they were not obviously given the chance to vote while they're outside the country, and that is something that probably should be looked at in future. But they also, they had an influence in making sure, you know, that, you know, be it their families, their parents back home, you know, they vote and they vote wisely. You know, but the conditions on the ground were not as easy. I'll tell you openly about, you know, my mother. You know, we have a family WhatsApp group, you know, where we talk, and we talk about anything and everything. But once I start talking about politics, you know, she doesn't comment. You know, I don't even know how she voted. In as much as I wanted to, you know, to educate her, okay, understand. Once I start that subject, you know, I know she will just disappear. She will just blue tick me. So, you know,
do you feel it's enough?
Because she feels.
Do you feel it's enough?
Sorry. I think we're trying under the circumstances. I think we're trying our best. But you know, we can't just blame Zimbabweans, or we can't just say maybe Zimbabweans are not doing enough. Now we have a situation where some people are even saying maybe South Africa is actually happy with what is happening in Zimbabwe. If
Zimbabweans are happy. But Zimbabweans are happy. So I hear what you're saying, that they have funded it, but they didn't go back to vote. They didn't, you know, all of those things. You want other people to do the heavy lifting on your behalf. So you are just as happy with what's happening in Zimbabwe. If you are willing for other people to get hurt, and you will not get hurt. I think as South Africans, one of the things that we look at and we think about our experience, if we think about the number of South Africans who abroad, and you say South Africa, Zimbabweans in the diaspora are doing stuff, but it's not in the mainstream. If you think about South Africans when they were abroad and all over the world, they were everywhere. They were agitating. That is why all over the world, people know about what was happening in this country, and they were able to rally behind what was happening in this country. Zimbabweans are okay to, maybe they are far from home, but they are comfortable in their restaurant jobs in South Africa.
Bumi, if I say now South Africa or the ruling party ANC is happy with what is happening in Zimbabwe, will you agree with me?
I think so.
Yes, they are. But they have South Africa. And Zimbabweans have Zimbabwe, and Zimbabweans are also happy with what's happening there.
But you know what, Pumi and Godfrey and Canton, and frankly everybody else, we all know that we've got a diaspora of our own all over the world. Mm. We're sitting here criticizing Zimbabwe, which is fair in some ways. I don't mind that. We don't need to be super sensitive about it. And I think Godfrey's trying to field these questions without actually having a mandate from all Zimbabweans. He doesn't represent a whole lot of Zimbabweans. He's just speaking as one person.
But does their president?
No, but South Africans are also spread all over the world because there are so few economic opportunities for them here.
The difference is that we are allowed to vote from anywhere in the world, Gareth. So
okay,
which is a big difference.
Fair enough. Mm. I wonder how many people take advantage of that.
Quite a few. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah, there were several hundred thousand votes that in the 2019 elections. Certainly, they were at the time.
No.
Look, can I toss in a couple of viewpoints out here, and let's get comments from our guest on this.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, you know, goes back to the time that we had a situation where it was very clear that Morgan Tsvangirai had won the election.
Yeah.
And
that was when Bob was still alive.
When Bob was still alive. And the stuff up on Tsvangirai's part at the time was really what he should have done, was stepped up to the plate and say, thank you to the people of Zimbabwe for this mandate that I've been given. And I would like to extend the hand of friendship to the armed forces of Zimbabwe and to assure them that they service to this country will continue unchecked during our time. Instead, he went to the rest of the world and said, I won the elections and they won't let me be president.
Where?
Exactly. So, you know, instead of at that time taking the bull by the horns, There was a stuff up. So Mbeki then brokered the deal that saw Mugabe as president and Tsvangirai as prime minister. And Mugabe then said to him,
their own little coalition.
Yeah, but he said, Mugabe then said to Tsvangirai, listen, guy, now that you've got the authority that you need, go to your Western backers and tell them to now start giving us money and start lifting sanctions. And Tsvangirai did that, and everyone extended the middle finger to him. And so Bob said, aha, you see. And Bob then went to the Chinese, who then gave Bob $1 billion, and the rest kind of became history from that point onwards. So, you know, the first thing is that the opportunity has been there in the past. But actual strength of leadership on the part of the opposition has actually been lacking. And to a large extent, it still does so to this day because, you know, the extent of the impact of geopolitics upon Zimbabwe is not actually interrogated by the opposition. Everything is all about the corruption of ZANU-PF. And make no mistake, ZANU-PF is corrupt in exactly the same way as the ANC is corrupt.
I just feel like it's become like a running gag now. When people talk about failed states and they talk about basket cases, they talk about Zimbabwe now all over the world. It came up. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and Venezuela and Zimbabwe are the names that come up all the time. Not Afghanistan, you know? It's Zimbabwe and Venezuela.
Although there are lots of things in Zimbabwe that actually work a lot better than they do out here.
Well, you go there often.
I go there often, sure. As you're fully aware. So the electricity situation is significantly better in Zimbabwe than it is out here, as a very good example.
Right.
I'm very happy to walk the streets of Harare without fear of getting mugged.
Yeah,
is another good example. So, and there are many parts of Zimbabwe where there are people who are living in absolute comfort and, you know, enjoying a fabulous lifestyle. And I'm talking very specifically in this case about white South Africans who have migrated to Zim and actually enjoy a quality of life that's, you know, second to none at a number of levels.
And there are lots of South Africans who've also gone to Zambia, Namibia, Botswana.
Yes. Right. Now the question in terms of what could be done to fix Zimbabwe, and I'm going to hand back to you in a second, but I just wanted to make this point apropos of the single thing that holds back Zimbabwe right now is its inability to get access to hard currency.
Okay.
Now, there was a moment of opportunity back when Tito Mboweni was governor. And at the time, when you might remember the trillion-dollar bills that Zim was printing at the time.
Sure.
And at that point, Mugabe first approached South Africa and said, we'd like to make use of the rand as our currency. And there was an opportunity there for Tito to actually grasp that and say, yes.
You think it would have been a good decision?
It would have been a good decision. Look, essentially, the rand is the de facto currency of Zimbabwe. It is.
Not the dollar.
The reason why they end up needing dollars out there is because of the fact that the only way you can buy fuel in the country right now is through dollars. And again, the reason for that is that they have to import their fuel in dollars. So, but like I said, the rand is the de facto currency, but it goes through the entire process of the gatekeepers in government then being able to decide who's actually able to get access to hard currency.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when we have a situation now where we actually end up having a means of interchange, and this is what we spoke about in terms of BRICS, that's going to make a seismic difference in the lives of Zimbabweans. And at that point, you know, things are going to change quite drastically. So I think right now, focusing on, you know, whether the elections were free and fair, I think, you know, to speak of free and fair elections in most parts of the world
it's a moot point. Yeah, okay.
So there's also a level of energy. We have a friend who's in asset management, and she also goes to Zimbabwe quite a lot, and she talks a lot about the infrastructure development that's happening and the kind of investment they're able to attract into Zimbabwe versus what they can attract here and the energy in Zimbabwe. So, you know.
Okay, Godfrey,
those flights that I'm on to Zim, okay, they are always filled with white Afrikaners who are generally working in the mining sector up in
right. Mines and infrastructure.
Yes, mines and infrastructure.
All right, so Godfrey, your comments on all of that. There was a lot there.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Kenton, you know, you spoke about the government of national unity, you know, that came through when Mogen Tsvangirai was still alive. And if I listen to you clearly, you know, you believe they didn't get to achieve, you know, what they wanted. But, I'll argue with you and say, you know, life was actually much better. If you talk to a lot of Zimbabweans right now, and, you know, they look back at that GNU and they feel, you know, things improved, you know, a great deal. Now, are you saying the opposition was supposed to, they won the election and they're supposed to, you know, get into power and not accept, you know, that deal? You know, but I'll tell you now that, you know, things are very different on the ground when it comes to, you know, Zimbabwean politics. Now, what is different between what happened then and what's happening now is, you know, the fact that, for instance, you know, for the first time, you know, we have, you know, SADC, you know, has a backbone. You know, we know that normally happens, you know, in when it comes to West Africa, you know, with ECOWAS, you know, they can come out and, you know, they can, you know, confront issues. But with SADC, most leaders, you know, that are obviously from the liberation movements, you know, they tend to, you know, team up and support each other, you know, protect each other, and they don't come up openly. Now they came out openly and they said, you know, this election was not, it fell short of the requirements of the Constitution of Zimbabwe, the Electoral Act, and the SADC principles and guidelines governing democratic elections. We, you know, we had 68 observers that were deployed by the, you know, by SADC, you know, about five of them that went to each province. And, you know, the report that they came up with was actually damning. The African Union itself, you know, again, you know, African Union, you know, they are very diplomatic. They don't say things as they are. But for the first time, they agreed, we know, with SADC. You know, they said, you know, they complained about the high registration fees. Look, you know, to contest in this election, you know, for someone to become a president, they had to fork out $20,000, you know, and, you know, that's unheard of. You must understand that in the previous elections, one had to pay
that's
about
pretty much what I paid in order to register the political
yeah,
party.
That's what we pay here as yeah. well, Kenton yeah. says.
Kenton, $20,000
So $20,000
Yeah,
you know, and MPs, I think it was $1,000, and that these are people that if they get, if they win and they become members of parliament, they're going to be earning something like $200. So, you know, you ask yourself, you know, does it really make sense? You know, it doesn't make sense. But that's, you know, that's what happened. We also have even the European Union. You know, they came through. I think we listened to Joseph Borrell. You know, he says no, the election was conducted in a climate of fear. You know, obviously, the U.S. Department of State spokesperson, you know, Matt Miller, he also said, you know, as the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission officials, you know, forced observers to sign, you know, altered polling station results. So, you know, with all these people that are coming out and they're saying, right, you know, the election was not free and fair.
You know what?
You know, that's the difference.
I think that horse is bolted. So I think we should leave it at that. And once again, Zimbabwe gets put on the back burner for another couple of years, I'm afraid. So Godfrey, I want you to stay on and comment on some of the stories here in South Africa, because I know you follow the news and you know a lot about what's going on here. And I'd like to have your opinion on these too. First thing, Pumi's just told me now, Raymond Ackerman just died. Of course, a giant of South African business. Someone who's had an enormous impact on the retail sector. He's been a very powerful businessman, an influence on business in this country. And obviously, you know, I think a loss, even though he wasn't actively involved in business for at least the last 20 years. Mm. Anything you want to add?
But many people still walk into a Pick and Pay.
Oh, Pick and Pay, yeah. I mean, that's him. That's the man. So Raymond Ackerman.
Has he actually died this time? Because
yes.
The last time around, there was...
Well, yeah, the fake news.
Release that was put out.
I read that you'd died once as well, Canton, but I see you here. So.
No, I died and went to heaven, and here I am. You know?
Apparently, he passed away yesterday. This is a... Yeah. It's an article in the Daily Maverick.
How old is he? In his 90s, huh?
In his 90s.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thought that was an important piece of news. The speaking of people who've made lots of money, there's a billionaire. This is in the news now as well. Michiel Leroux, who's pumping millions of rands into South Africa's main opposition, the Democratic Alliance. He's also supported Herman Mashaba's Action SA, My Money's Build One SA. The EFF did not declare any donations. The Democratic Alliance have had to acknowledge over 22 million rand in donor funding. The ANC acknowledged 20 million.
There's a new name on that Action SA list. Did you see?
Who's that?
Have you got the? I don't have the list.
I don't have the complete list. No.
An individual.
Yes.
Who put in almost 7.5 million rand in the last quarter into Action SA.
Wow.
So they are soliciting enough support because, as we know, you need deep pockets to.
You need deep pockets, but then this is, you know, in America, for example. Party funding is just through the roof. The amounts of money are astronomical. In South Africa, how do you think it should work?
In the States, they have a big machinery around funding, but they also have lots of individual donors. And I think Barack Obama was one of the first ones who spoke quite openly about how he was able to solicit lots of
small donations
well, that was from individuals.
That was the first real crowdfunding that happened in politics.
And South Africa also needs a lot more of that. You know, we have a lot of lip service of people who feel that there are lots of billionaires pulling the strings of politicians. But people are not willing to sign a stop order to give 100 rand a month to whatever political party they believe in. Kenton, very famously, you guys funded your own party.
Yes, we did. That was, and of course, we took the extraordinary step of listing every single donation on the website.
Which I think should be the way all parties behave from now on. So we can see who the major funders are and find out whether or not they are exercising influence on those parties.
But very seriously, South Africans.
Yes, Godfrey?
Yes, Godfrey.
No, I was just about to say, you know, I think, you know, it is obvious, you know, when someone invests in a party, you know, they fund them, they're expecting something in return. You know, let's just be, you know, honest about it. I don't think they just, you know, donate for the sake of it.
But Godfrey, and you made a point a little bit earlier that people were expected to register for $1,000 and they only earn $200 back. And one of the problems that we have across the continent is kleptocracy. And it is exactly that kind of thinking, that people go into government to become rich or to make money. You go into government to serve your country. You go into government to make a better place in your country. That's what you get in return. What you get in return is good policies that allow interview. And you don't have to be in politics forever. You can go into government and public service for a period of time and then go into private sector where you make your millions. But you can't expect to make millions in the public service. That money is supposed to be for the betterment and upliftment of our country, not
exactly
for people
like
to become
it happens
rich.
In which part of the world, Pumi?
Yeah, that's a little idealistic. Yeah,
it is okay that it is idealistic.
Godfrey says he's happy to move to that country as well.
Oh, of course. Godfrey is happy to leave anywhere that's not serving him to a place that will serve him instead of fixing where he should be.
Well, isn't that the way of the world at the moment? People can move wherever they want, surely.
Gareth, can we get Godfrey's take on what's happening in West Africa? Because I don't want us to get too...
I don't want to leave this alone yet because Michiel Leroux is the guy who started Capitec Bank.
Mm. Yes.
He's worth $1 billion. He could put his money wherever he likes. I prefer the fact that he's actually reinvesting in South Africa rather than putting it in some Swiss bank account.
Because that's where his market is.
Yes, but that's exactly the point. So you look after your own, you clean your own house, right? I agree. I agree. But I do think it's interesting too that we're living in a country where people, Pumi says we must crowdfund political parties, that people don't have money.
Must fund their own freedom.
Enoch Godongwana, who's on your WhatsApp group, Pums, the finance minister.
It's a rumor at this stage because he hasn't said nothing.
The finance minister has hinted at possible tax increases because we're broke as a country. This is the rumor that's spreading around now. To fund the government's
economy.
Growing expense bill, Godongwana said South Africa's economic growth and tax revenue had been stifled by the energy and rail crisis. Oh, you don't say. And I wonder whose fault that is. Which has reached record levels of load shedding and logistics backlogs. Godongwana, and by the way, I'm so sick of trucks on the highway. I'm so up to here with trucks. Okay, I know that they have no option because our rail system is disastrous. But
you saw Porsche Adobe's performance. Porsche Adobe's performance there at Transnet this past weekend.
Transnet are running now at a huge loss. They were running at a huge profit. Anyway, they want to increase taxes, which is challenging and unpopular, to say the least. Borrow more money, which is, you know, there are only so many people in the world who are dumb enough to lend our government money. And then budget cuts, which also have limitations before hurting the system. No. We can do lots of budget cuts in this country. They just don't want to do them. So any comments on that before we move on from money to West Africa?
Well, the most logical thing that we should be doing is raising VAT. But our government will not do that.
Because it's unpopular and hits everybody equally.
Yes.
If we raised VAT, what sort of, if you were in charge now, what would you propose? How much?
Look, even
we're at what, 15% now?
Yeah, we're on 15. Yeah, push it up to 16.
That's all? One percentage point? How much do you think it would bring in?
Well, let's take a look at the last budget stuff. And I'm just heading across
There's a midterm coming up budget.
While Canton's looking that up, do you think that's a good plan for me?
I don't think it's a good plan because I don't think throttling our economy any further, where we know that the consumer is already cash strapped.
You say no more tax.
No
more tax.
In fact, I think that what they need to be doing is they need to be looking at places where they can ease up on the tax for people to allow more money into the environment.
Godfrey, what's your take on this?
You know, if we go with Kenton's idea of increasing VAT, I'm telling you, I can assure you we will have some protests, people running into the streets, because that's going to affect...
We have daily protests in this country, in almost every part of the country. It doesn't get reported
by
mainstream
media. We can afford more.
All right. Have you found the numbers?
No, I haven't found the numbers. Okay.
All right. While you're looking for that, there's still other stuff we've got to get to before we can move to West Africa. They're going to do lifestyle audits. Pumi and I have briefly mentioned this. The president himself has said they're going to do a lifestyle audit on him and on the deputy president and members of the cabinet. But it's taking longer than planned. Surprise, surprise. Addressing the National Assembly on Tuesday, he said lifestyle audits for public servants in government have been compulsory since March 2021. And over 11,000 public servants have gone through the process.
Yeah, he did say, there was a number.
Can we see those?
11,000, I thought it was 100 and something.
Why isn't that published? Why can't we see what our supposed leaders, our representatives have in terms of hard assets and where their money is?
What I'm more interested in is who are the people that get targeted? Why is it these 11,000 nameless, faceless people instead of starting at the top? Why are we not starting at the top?
We should, if you are in government.
It seems to me to be a tool of keeping people in check. Kind of like the way Eskom is now doing a probe.
We know
into
this.
Whistleblowers rather than what has been whistleblown on.
This is like Joe Biden going after Elon Musk for trying to build a glass house in Austin, Texas. It's the same thing. You punish your political enemies. So it seems that no politicians are above that.
One of these days, I think we're going to be having a conversation about how the SIU is a political tool there in the
Absolutely
presidency.
Absolutely it is. Absolutely
there
it is.
In the presidency to keep people in line.
Well, some people say lifestyle audits are a waste of time. You're just giving money to consulting firms.
So anyway, figures.
Okay,
so,
here we go.
Tax revenue 2023-24, 640 billion came from personal income tax, 471.5 billion from VAT, and 336 billion from corporate income tax. So
it's exactly the opposite of the amount of say we have in the economy. People who are paying personal income tax have the least say in the economy.
Correct.
Businesses have the most say in the economy and contribute only third place.
Yes.
And the average person in the population who is not necessarily taxed on their income but has to pay for, you know, general transactions.
Yes, but the reason for that is it's inversely proportional to the amount of power that you actually have.
Correct.
So in the case of personal income tax, because we have no way of actually doing a tax revolt because our PAYE gets deducted before we receive our salaries. So right. We're not able to protest at that point. So that's the way it works. But by my very basic calculation right now, so from 471 billion rand, a 1% increase in that would then push the tax revenues up to 502 billion rand, that 1 percentage point the increase.
Do you think that'll be enough to cover all the graft and corruption?
No, it certainly will not be enough to cover graft and corruption, but it'll certainly make a dent in the cost of the diesel that we are needing to burn to keep the economy ticking over.
It is interesting. I think everybody's realized this, that during BRICS, load shedding was very much curtailed. It wasn't as big a problem.
Well, they burnt massive amounts of diesel in order to keep it going. And, you know, this is something that we've spoken about before, that we can continue burning diesel if we raise the price of electricity. But whenever we try raising the price of electricity, we have all of these action groups that turn around and say, no, you're not allowed to raise the price of electricity. So,
well, I don't know about you, but my bills for utilities went up almost doubled.
Sure.
In the last couple of weeks. Well, last month before. Is that normal? Should we be anticipating that every couple of months?
I think we should be anticipating that. But remember the positive spin-off of this.
Positive?
Yeah.
Not to my bank balance.
No, Gareth.
This is exactly what Cyril said yesterday, that we should be looking at this positively.
The positive spin-off on this is that it's forcing more and more people off grid.
Yeah.
That is a positive spin-off. Guys, you should not underestimate how important this is. Getting people off grid so that they then accepting personal responsibility for generating their own energy in their home space means that there's less money for Eskom to end up stealing. And the rolling blackouts will continue to be a thing. But remember, at the same time, there's lack of enforcement around people who don't pay, which is, again, a nettle that the government is not prepared to grasp.
Right. Okay, you wanted
to. So while we talk about electricity, do you know where our Minister of Electricity was?
Is this Sputla, Sputla Ramakgopa?
After all the dancing.
He was chatting with an attractive woman about green energy.
What's this?
So he's already doing a bad job being the Minister of Electricity because he really hasn't done much, right. Hasn't made a dent.
I only make assumptions that she's attractive because he was chatting to her.
And now, as of yesterday, he has been made chairperson of the Africa Green Hydrogen Alliance.
Oh, I don't know if we're meant to.
He's in Nairobi as we speak.
Do we applaud now?
So he's already doing one bad job, and now he's accepting more responsibility.
So he can do two bad jobs. Are you excited about this, Godfrey? Does this make a difference in your life?
Obviously, yeah, it, you know, in terms of the load shedding.
No, just does it, do you care, do you give a fisherman's fuck, to use that terminology, about our Minister of Electricity being put in charge as chairperson of some hydrogen energy group? Or is this just another talk shop that's going to result in nothing? I think it's a yes or no question.
I don't think it does much, you know, for an ordinary person on the ground. You're talking about the Minister of Electricity. It was exciting, you know. It was, I don't know whether I should use the word exciting, but, you know, when he was appointed, you know, everyone was hopeful, you know, that
things
wasn't.
Would change.
No, I was not. That's a very Zimbabwean take on this.
But he came with a good track record, and because of
he ran Swane for a while and ran it badly. I don't see his good track record.
We lost Godfrey.
No, he doesn't know the answer to
are
that.
We talking, are we
I remember because I live in Swane, and he was our mayor for a time, and he was a terrible mayor. Part of what we're dealing with right now is. In Swane is as a result of that mismanagement under his administration. So No, I don't think he had a good track record.
What did JJ say last week? An absolute pleasure. JJ had a very funny term about the mess that was left at Tshwane for the DA to...
I can't remember, but it was. It's worth re-listening just to find that term. Listen. All right, so we want to talk ECOWAS. Why is this pertinent to you, Kansan? What's important there?
It's not ECOWAS specifically.
But Western Africa?
Just generally the stuff that's happening in West Africa right now. And so, you know, I don't know if you followed what happened in Chad over the past couple of days. So essentially, France has had troops stationed in a significant chunk of Francophone Africa for the longest time. This week there was an altercation between a Chad citizen and some of the French troops stationed out there, and this Chad citizen was killed by the French troops. So there's now an uprising in Chad to get the French troops out of the country. So now there's actually a pattern that's emerging in most of Francophone Africa.
Yeah, JJ Cornish told us about this on Tuesday and said that the French Prime Minister has said that the ambassador must stay there. Stay there, he's got important work to do, and the troops are not going anywhere.
Well, I think what's pretty much going to be the situation is that the French troops are going to have great difficulty feeding themselves, on the assumption that they're pretty much encircled and they're not able to come and go as they please. Very much so in the case of the French ambassador as well. I'll be very interested to see how that actually plays out. The interesting thing for me in terms of the coup government right now in Niger is that they're very much playing by the rules in terms of diplomacy. Hmm. So, they've been issuing official communiques to the French government and saying we've actually no longer recognized your ambassador and you need to withdraw him from the country.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, so it's – yeah, I would
they
suspect
– they did put out a statement of that nature.
Yes. That was many weeks ago.
All right, so Godfrey, your comments on this. Chad, Niger, what do you think's going on here?
Yeah, no, I think, there is, a wave of, these coups, taking place in West Africa. We know in Niger from July 2023, they ousted, Bazoum and, General Thiam, came through. And it's not just there, in Guinea again, I think in 2021, September, Mamadi Doumbouya came through in Sudan, Abdel Fattah in 2019, in Burkina Faso. I know a lot of ladies, they love Ibrahim Traore. We saw him when he went to Russia for those talks. He was all over, social media. In Mali, Assimi Goïta came through in 2021 when they, got rid of Boubacar Keïta. In Gabon, we have General Brice. But if you look at all these coups, they are trying to, like what Kenton said, they're trying to be very diplomatic. They're trying to avoid, the word coup. I think it started with Zimbabwe when they ousted Robert Mugabe. They said it was a coup. That was not a coup, obviously, because they were trying to avoid the sanctions that come through with them officially, saying, this is a coup and we're taking over. But if there's something interesting that is coming out of these coups, like, what Kenton said, I think we can say that in Gabon and in Niger, France is, the French, government is, under a lot of pressure. They are pushing them out. And, this is something that does not sit well with them because they stand to benefit a lot out of some of these countries that are very rich when it comes to oil. So yeah, it's very interesting to see how it pans out. And for one to think that it is a solution to come up with these coups, I don't think it's something that we really need to celebrate.
It makes your job as a Pan-Africanist that much harder because it seems like something that we just have not graduated out of yet. There's the peaceful transfer of power just does not seem to be a thing in parts of this continent still.
No, it's not going away, you know, anytime soon. And if you look at it, you know, there are always reasons, you know, that people, you know, come through. In some of these countries, they are saying, no, you're not handling these Islamic insurgents, you know, very well. Mm-hmm. In Gabon, they said no. It was just an hour after the election results were announced. And you know, they just didn't want President Ali Bongo to continue. And this is a family that has been in power since I think 1967.
That's
It's if it dies, you know, someone comes up and they continue
more than
like that.
More than half a century that family have been in charge in Gabon.
Yes, and I'm sure you saw even on social media when they got arrested, even his son when they arrested, they had millions and millions, of money in their suitcases. Mm. And I think Pumi said earlier on that, you get into power so that you can serve, which is a very noble, thing to say. But in reality, that's not what is happening. They get in power so that they can enrich themselves.
Yeah, that is the flaw that we currently have as a continent. And we have too much patience. We have too much patience with thieving leaders. We have too much patience with individuals. And also, we have too much patience with allowing the worst of us, quite honestly, to ascend to these positions. But it's not a noble ideal. I mean, Norway has the biggest sovereign wealth fund in the world, and they look after their people. Like, it's not a noble ideal. Yeah.
But let's not forget that the way in which Norway actually ended up getting access to that sovereign wealth fund was basically because of oil wealth, which they are now trying to prevent the rest of the world who actually have oil reserves.
Yeah, I mean, we should be doing that.
From actually exploiting. Niger, just to put this in perspective, they were selling uranium to France at 80 cents a kilogram. 80 as in, cents of in the euro.
Okay? Right.
Yeah, so it was 0.8 euros. What they have now done is they have pushed the price of uranium that to France to 200 euros per kilogram.
Right.
And okay. We know exactly how that goes.
Yeah, which is...
They've just replaced the people who were there with suitcases of dollars in their...
Yeah.
In their
Now, the other issue, guys, and, again, this is in terms of actual control of monetary policy. Do some reading on the CFA, Frank. There's a fairly extensive Wikipedia entry on it. But essentially, France has controlled the economies of all of these territories because of the fact that France actually issues the currency that gets used in these territories. Mm. So the currency is nominally pegged to the euro, and it's at a percentage of the euro. But consider this. You have a colonial power that is responsible for printing your currency and effectively controlling your money supply. But at the same time, they're printing the currency that you make use of, and which pretty much gives them leverage to print as much of it as they want themselves to then use to pay you for the stuff that they are buying from you, which means effectively they are getting all of the stuff for nothing.
And why would these countries keep putting up with that?
Well, because they are occupied countries. I go back to this entire thing that says, if you have foreign troops on your soil, you are an occupied country.
Mm-hmm.
If you look in terms of geopolitics today, World War II ended, but Europe is still occupied by the Americans, and it has been almost every single country there. You got U.S. troops on the ground.
Correct.
South Korea, you're an occupied country. Japan, you're an occupied country. And it really is as simple as that. Ditto in the case of West Africa. Yeah. There are French troops on the ground.
And
you don't
Wagner
have your
troops.
Sovereignty. You don't control your currency. You don't have sovereignty.
And now they have Wagner troops too.
And does anyone have an update? Perhaps you know this, Godfrey. What's happening with all these Wagner troops since Prigozhin was killed? Are they going to hang around in Africa, wait for a new leader? Are they all going to form little atomized military groups in various places run by warlords? Do we have any updates on what's going on there, especially in places like the Central African Republic, which is...
And Mali. Yeah. Well, Pumi? The Kremlin has appointed a new leader for Wagner.
Okay. Mm. Well, that's convenient. So he's in charge now.
They continue.
Yeah, but Yeah, but we all knew that you know, it was not he was not going to get away with it. It was just a matter of time. You know, so you know, for when he eventually died, you know, it was expected.
Eventually, I think. When his plane mysteriously lost the use of its wing,
you don't play with Putin.
That's exactly right. All right. Before we close this off, we've got 6 minutes left. We have to refer to some of the big international stories. We've mentioned Macron and France already. There's quite a lot going on since BRICS that I think has got people talking. Of course, Lula and
there'll be G20
happening. There's G20
happening India.
Soon. Where do you want to go first? Because we've got limited time here.
G20 is kind of an interesting thing happening right now because, of course, India is hosting the G20.
And mm-hmm. she's not going.
No, but she made it very clear. The reason why Xi is not going is not because he has a problem with India. Xi has made it very clear that he has no intention of meeting Biden.
Ah, very good.
And it really is as simple as that.
Okay, so okay. He's now written him off.
Yeah, he's written him off. We see consistent reports that come out from the U.S. that Biden has been reaching out to Putin. Putin will not take his calls.
Oh, really?
Or from anyone in the U.S., yes.
This has got to be the first time in a long time that a U.S. president's been ignored.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. So the only time that that the Russians actually paid attention was at the point at which Biden was visiting Kiev, and the Russians took note and they held off on attacks on Kiev until Biden was able to get out of there. So the back channels are still open, but Putin refuses to take his calls.
Does India have a new name?
India is very possibly – it's not a new name.
It's the name for India.
No, but Bharat has always been the Hindi name of India, and what they're thinking of doing is just –
how do we spell that?
B-H-A-R-A-T.
Bharat.
Which is actually the name of a king who ruled most of India a few thousand years ago, but renounced his kingdom, adopted Jainism, and went off to become a recluse, having successfully united the country. It's actually quite a
what a story.
It's actually quite a cool story.
So shall we refer to it as Bharat from now on?
Look, you know,
I mean, if we refer to Port Elizabeth as Rebecca, then why not?
Look, you know. A rose by any other name. I think that, again, this is something that, you know, India was the name that the Brits gave to all of the territories lumped together, which, remember, at the time composed what today became Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal.
Well, it's an ancient word for everything that was east of the Indus River.
No, it isn't that ancient. So the Sanskrit word for it, for the Indus River was Sindhu. The Indus River was the name that was put in place by the Aryans who came across from predominantly what's today modern-day Iran. And so they conquered as they went along. So the Dravidians, who were my ancestors who lived in the Indus Valley, then got pushed to the south of India. So – yeah, but the Indus, the Pakistan word for it was, the Sanskrit word for it was always Sindhu as opposed to Indus. And in fact, it's in the Indian national anthem. Hmm. You know, it talks about Punjab, Sindhu, Gujarat, Maharashtra, which are various territories.
I think it's very nice to be Indian right now. Kenton, I'm sure you agree with me. Because recently, you know, India, obviously, you know, we saw a lot of countries trying to join BRICS, and India is part of that. And now they are hosting the G20 summit. But I think it should be expected. I mean, for a country that is a population of over 1.5 billion people, you know, they should have that kind of influence.
I'm just concerned that the BRICS acronym will have to change because I was the only vowel in BRICS. Now we've got a bit of a problem. What are we going to
do? I think they said it's not going to change.
We've got Argentina and Egypt.
BRICS plus 6 or BRICS plus 7.
The new BRICS.
They can keep BRICS plus 10, depending on the number of countries that join.
You see, the interesting thing that people don't consider about BRICS, guys, and we need to get people to think along these lines. BRICS is not an alliance. Okay, so it's very different to NATO, for example.
Which they're not talking about coming to each other's defense if anyone's attacked.
Absolutely.
Have their own intra.
It's essentially a body that's establishing economic rules for trading among the various member states, and it's a huge difference. So there's no contradiction, for example, between Russia having its what do they call themselves? The CIS, that's their defense equivalent of NATO. India is part of the Quad, which includes the U.S. In the Pacific region. So the military alliances. Godfrey.
But instead of talking about things like the seat in the Security Council, United Nations Security Council, which is I think something that is very interesting because like you said, normally they talk about the economy, and they stand there. But now it looks like they are extending and they're getting to talk about many other things as well.
Isn't it interesting, Godfrey and Canton and Pumi, that the UN has become such an unused term? I don't think anyone's particularly interested in what they're... Everyone's talking G20, BRICS. The UN is like a relic now, I'm afraid. Don't you think?
The world has changed.
India would in fact have been part of the UN Security Council just in terms of its participation in the Second World War.
Yeah.
If not for the fact that at the time India was part of the British Empire. And so effectively... India lost out on having a seat on the UN Security Council at the time. So it essentially became Russia, China.
My point is no one cares about the UN.
Yes, but the Security Council is still, happens to be the place where decisions ultimately get made. And so now it is fundamentally dysfunctional because as long as Russia and China have vetoes, which they do, nothing actually comes out of it.
It's a stalemate.
Yes. So, but you're exactly right, Garrett. There will be increasing reliance on all of these other bodies that, effectively define policies at a number of other levels.
Right.
But it's kind of like those climate conferences. They don't really have the power to enforce anything.
Pointless. All right. That's all we got time for. So, Godfrey, thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's good to have you on the show. And
we didn't even get to talk about Godfrey's poetry.
No. But the Burning Platform is no place for poetry, Pumi. But thank you, Godfrey. And we will see you soon. Thank you very much. Pumi,
thank you
Canton.
Very much. It was nice being with you on the Burning Platform.
Thank you.
Nice chatting to you, Pumi, Canton. We just hope this spirit of coups doesn't spread into Zimbabwe, where there's also a disputed election. I mean, we had the president of Cameroon. I think he's also afraid that it might come through to him.
Well, hasn't he? He's been there for years as well, Cameroon, right?
Kagame has fired lots of his generals in the past week. Yeah.
So Paul
reorganized his presidential guard. He was just like, don't you get any ideas, Negros?
All right, we'll end the show on that. All right, thank you very much, Godfrey. Thank you, Pumi and Canton. Cheers, everybody. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Be good. CliffCentral.com